Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's May 18th, 2012. You're listening to the best PokerCast in the world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Hey, did you actually play Papes last night?
I did. You know, it's been a long time. You know, I made that New Year's resolution about 7 New Years ago that I wanted to play more because I kind of missed it. And it's fun talking to the fans again. And I had a blast last night. One, conversing the entire time and joking with folks. Even did a little scoreboard when I was at the top of the list. Of course, you know, you should never do that because you know you're never going to win when you get pompous like that. I should learn things from you. But yeah, you know, I'm getting ready to go on this trip, and I was winding down, and I saw somebody tweeted about Papes. I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to get in last night. So I did, and of course I played both. You know, you have the real called the Cosenza Papes, the second chance.
Yeah,
the one that you always think is the big one.
Yeah,
because you know you're not very bright when it comes to scheduling. But I played both, and of course it was Raz last night, which, you know, in the past I used to try to get some work done when I'm doing these things, but it's tough to do with Raz, but particularly with two of them. You know, you got tables going back and forth, but,
yeah.
But it was kind of cool to play Raz again. You know, it kind of reminded me that it's a game that is pretty easy fundamentally, isn't it?
Yeah, I think
so. In other words, you don't have to make a lot of... It strips away some of the tougher decisions that you normally have in poker. That doesn't mean that it's not an easy game. I mean, there's some real skill involved, and it's kind of a razor-thin skill. But for the most part, you know, the hand kind of plays itself in the beginning. Like, for example, if everybody folds and there's a king bring in, you know, you automatically complete, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What you have. You could be rolled up. So it was stuff like that. But I really enjoyed playing it, and... here's why I think Raz is such an awesome game. Now, when I say awesome, I don't mean as in it is the best game in the world and everybody should play it, but just it's awesomely brutal.
And before we move on, for our new listeners, Papes is the Play Money Ante-Up Intercontinental Poker Series that we were forced to do because of Black Friday, since... we had the Ante-Up Intercontinental Poker Series, which was wildly successful for years. Because, you know, people started listening to us talking about Papes. They don't know what the hell we're talking about if they're brand new to the show. So it's a Play Money series that we host on PokerStars, or at least PokerGeek, our Minnesota ambassador hosts for us. So anyway, all right, so go ahead.
All right, so here's a couple things.
Well, what are you doing there? Because you're making so much noise over there. Our fans are like, is Scott paying attention to us, or is he paying attention to his house? They want to know. They want your full dedication to the show.
I had to move to a comfortable place.
So stop making noise.
Because Raz is not a comfortable game. All right, so here's a couple things that I think is awesome about Raz. In the main event, I started with Ace Trey 4-5.
Okay.
All right, now, we're not going to get into a lot of strategy here with Raz, but it's... pretty hard to do better than that on your first four cards, correct?
That's correct.
And so at that point, I got it all in against a short stack, right? And because I was all in, I was in a hand in the Cosenza Papes. So I flipped over there to actually play that one out. And when I flipped back to the main one, I'm like, the guy's still in the tournament. What happened? And I looked down... I finished, Chris, with an ace, tray, 4-5, king.
Brick, brick, brick.
And not just
brick.
bricks. I mean, I didn't even see what I actually got, but if I finished with a king, I had to, like, either get all... They had to be all kings or pairs.
Yeah, that's it.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And so they were giving me some good nature humor in there, like, wow, I've never seen that happen before. All right, now, in the other tournament, I actually brought it in with a four. Now, again, if folks haven't played Raz, it's just like Stud, except the high card brings in rather than the low card. So in regular Stud, bringing in with a four happens all the time. In Raz, I mean, think about this. I mean, it was six-handed at the time, so it wasn't a full table. But even a six-handed, how amazing is that, yeah, bringing in with a four?
Yeah. That's unbelievable.
I mean, the worst you could bring it in is with a three at a full table, right? Everybody has deuces and everybody has trays, and you have the tray of spades. I had a four. I mean, that's like total pippage, the game. And, of course, I didn't have anything to go with it, so it wasn't even exciting to bring it in with a four. But I'm like, wait. Four of spades? I want to bring it in!
Yeah, because you could have done the unassisted triple play rarity of completing with the bring it in Raz, which never happens.
Until you get heads up, and we'll talk about that later. Now, there's another guy, Buffalo something or other, I figure. I'm going to call him Buffalo Thunder, because that sounds more fun, but it wasn't. Buffalo World, Buffalo something, Buffalo Bill, I don't know, Buffalo somebody. Right?
Okay.
Was playing in the Cosenza Papes. First hand of the tournament, he has 3-8 showing on his board.
Oh, my God.
And I giggled, right? Ended up losing. About literally four hands later, he had 3-8 showing on his board again and won the hand.
What?
Won the hand with trips showing.
Oh, man. First of all, how does it even get to that point that he's still in the hand with 3-8? And then he wins it?
Yep.
Wow. Even if he has ace, deuce, eight, he's still got to go perfect to have a decent hand.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a great game, isn't it?
That's the one thing, you know, when we all embraced Raz way back when, we all made buttons that said, let's play Raz, and we all wore them proudly and everything. It was because we were hold'em geeks. You know, you were limit, I was no limit, and we were like trying to embrace Stud somehow, and we weren't bright enough to capture the nuances of Stud 8 and real Stud. So we're like, let's play Raz. You know, we don't have to worry about the flushes and everything. And it was great in the beginning because you knew where you stood and everything. But it took us a little while to realize, you know what? Ace 3-4-5, we ain't got nothing yet.
Nope.
You know what I mean? And it's like, you still don't have a hand yet. Whereas, at least in Stud High, you got a wheel draw and you got ace high. Yeah, you know, ace high is something.
Worse, yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, man, you can't get worse. That's, brutal.
It is absolutely a brutal game. Another thing, too, in the main event, I started off well. I was in the ship leader for quite a while. You know, then the blinds get up, and then have a couple hands where you break out. You know how it goes, right?
Right.
So I ended up, I was down to 400 units. AZ Slick, all pompous over there, with 4,000. Last longer? Hee-hee-hee-hee. And I'm like, hee-hee-hee-hee-hee. And guess who's laughing today, Chris?
But did you make an actual last longer wager?
No.
All right, well, that doesn't count then. Because then you're not playing scared, or you're not playing to, you know, you're just happening to last longer with him. But if he said, let's put $500 down on this, I don't think you would have taken him up on it. And two, I think you both would have played a little differently, and we don't know what the real outcome would have been. So.
Well, I'll guarantee you, I 400. I had to get it in on the next two hands at that point. Just got lucky to double up a couple times and go on the heater. But but yeah. So I ended up finishing fifth in the main game, and then ended up heads up with Gambit, our good friend, and Cosenza Papes. And I believe I had a 6-1 chip lead on him heads up. And guess who took home the title?
No way.
Not me.
Oh, man. Gambit's like your kryptonite.
He is.
The home game, you struggle at his house.
Max freaking Luthor.
Oh,
absolutely.
My God. Absolutely brutal. Yeah, 6-1 chip lead, heads up in Raz, and you didn't win.
Yeah. And I had, it was probably a 4-1 chip lead over the whole field when it was three-handed. You know, we ended up getting the third player out, and I think I took him out. So that's when I had that massive chip lead, and then... You know, it's just, you know, heads up in general is pretty brutal. I mean, you think back to some of the pros that have lost like 6-1 chip leads and no limit hold'em. You know, yeah. How frustrating it is.
Yeah.
But Raz, I mean, you can't get it all in. You just got to do this raise back and forth. And just as you mentioned earlier in the show, you start really strong means nothing.
Yep.
Means nothing. You keep breaking out, and the other person gets better. And the pivotal hand, I think we were almost even in chips, and he pipped me on the fourth card. So the first three cards were all the same. The fifth card was the same. And the fourth card in the lineup, he had one pip more than I did, or less than I did.
Yeah, I remember one time playing, it was like a, I don't know, 20+2 heads-up horse title against some event against some guy, and we were playing, and when we got to Raz, it was like, every time you're the bring-in, we have to agree that the other guy raises and the bring-in folds automatically so we can get through these eight hands, or whatever it was, and he's like, all right, let's do that. So now we just literally did not play Raz, and it kind of got frustrating, too, because I think I was the bring-in more than he was, and I was losing hands, and I was like, I shouldn't have agreed to this, but it was pretty funny. The guy asked me, and I was like, "Yeah, all right, we'll skip Raz, whatever." You know, I ended up winning the turn, so I didn't care. But it was very frustrating when I did that. But it's such a frustrating game, and it's the same with triple draw games. They're all the same beast, you know, because you're not really starting with anything. You know, I mean, yeah, you got a good starting hand, but to call it a hand, it's like ridiculous. You call it a finger or something because it's not really a hand yet. You know, it's like you got three fingers to a hand. You don't have anything yet. You have a claw or something. I don't know. But it is frustrating, and I can't believe you had a double dose of it last night. I saw the tweet from Austin Bluffs last night,
yeah.
But I saw it too late, and then I was like, maybe I'll play in the 10 o'clock one. And I was like, you know, I'm kind of tired. And then I actually, when I thought about it again, it was like 10:15, and I was like, all right, forget it. I can't do it now.
But yeah, a lot of fun, folks. If you're not on the Papes list, I think you can get all the information on our forum at anyupmagazine.com/forum, and then you can join the group on the PokerStars home game application. And sometime, hopefully here soon, we'll get back to Apes and be able to retire the P. But in the meantime, it's just kind of... In fact, actually, in a lot of ways, it's a little more fun, actually, because, you know, there's no money on the line here. People are just joking around the entire time.
Yeah, yeah.
But definitely check it out. That next one, they play on the sixes, as we call it for TV. So.
And make sure you get there early because we have massive fields. You don't want to get shut out of these papes. I mean, we're talking thousands of people playing this thing. So
you know, that was the funny other thing too about the Raz too. I sat down, I started having a conversation with someone. I got moved in the second hand to another table because I think what happened is a 17th person entered, so they had to create a third table.
Oh yeah.
So they moved us all over. We finished off that table. I moved to the other table in the tournament that I wasn't already in. So I played all three tables.
Jeez.
Unfortunately, we only have one table at the home game.
Yeah. Speaking of Gambit in the home game, we had one this week, or last week, I guess. And it was weird because you, Gambit, and I were in a hand that we thought was worth talking about. Very interesting hand. And it's one of those things where it's like the polar opposite of the normal lesson that accompanies this sort of situation. And I just thought it was real interesting that it involved the three of us. And it was no limit, too, which is another interesting facet of this. If it was a limit, it wouldn't have been of note at all because you just would have been called down. So, but why don't you set this hand up for us a little bit?
Oh, wow. You know, I'm not sure I really, to be honest, I don't remember the details.
Oh, I remember everything.
I know you do. You always do. And that's going to be part of my point in this, what's going to be, I think, a very insightful story. So you can set it up.
Okay.
And I will chime in with my thoughts.
Well, Scott had come home from California on a massive heater. he had pretty much hit everything and even the kitchen sink when he was in California, and he came home with a massive amount of money. So he had been riding a heater, so we were fully aware of that. And then it continued in the home game. Early on, he had a massive stack. I mean, when you're playing 2-4 and Scott pretty much doubles his buy-in the first 40 minutes, let's just say he got hit in the head with the deck again. So
and playing all limit games.
Yeah, and it was all pretty much limit. So it was pretty ridiculous how much money he had in front of him or Skittles or whatever.
Yes.
And so when it got to the non-limit portion, Scott was like, I'm going to push everybody around my stack, you know. And got to a hand where I was in a blind, and I believe Mark was in the big blind. So I was small blind, big blind, and Scott was first to act. And Scott raised, and let's just say it was quarter 50 cent or whatever like that. And Scott raises to $1.50 or $2 or whatever. And when it got to me in the small blind, it folded around to me. I looked down at 7-5 of hearts. And I was like, you know what? This is a folding hand. But Scott's got a lot of money in front of him. And if I can hit the right flop, maybe I can take it from him. So I figured if I called the raise, Gambit would get out. And but that didn't make sense because if I call the raise, it gives him better odds. So for some reason, I was thinking that we were going to be heads up. And so I called the raise, and so did Mark. So I was like, okay, we're three-hand. It's still not big of a deal. I got connectors, sort of. And so I had 7-5, and the flop came 5 high. And it was like 5-3-4. And I think there was a heart. So I checked because I let Scott take the lead on, and Gambit checks, and Scott bets. And it was something like $4 or something, $3 or $4. Because the pot wasn't that big. So now I'm like, I got top pair, and I have a gut shot. So I'm like, all right, let me... Or was it a gut shot? I had top pair, and then I had the 7. So I was like, all right, let me call, and then if Mark gets out, then I'll bet out on the flop. And what I probably should have done is I should have raised there, and I didn't. So I call, and Mark calls. So I'm like, Mark called. So the turn is a 6, which I believe now gives me an open and a straight draw because I had 4, 5, 6, 7. Because I think it might have been 2, 4, 5, not 3. It was 2, 4, 5, I think. Because at the turn I had an open and a straight draw. It was 7, 6, 5, 4. That was what I had, and so I also had second pair because it was a 6 on the turn. But still, I'm thinking Scott raised pre-flop. If he doesn't have a pair, he's not going to have a pair with a 6 now. Now Scott bets again after we checked to him. And it was like a decent amount too, like $6. So I call, and then Mark calls again. So now I'm like, whoa, does Mark have the straight already? Why is Mark just calling here? And I don't think there was a flush draw now. I think it ended up being 4 suits on the turn. And I fully admit I totally misplayed this hand. I'm not saying I did or didn't. The river is a blank. It doesn't complete my straight. It doesn't complete any flush, obviously. And it's something like it might have been like a king or a queen or something. But now it's a high enough card that, you know, maybe even an ace. Scott bets 10 now. And every single street, he's firing away like Stu Unger, man. He's not afraid to have two players behind him calling. And I'm like, God, I just don't believe him. But the problem is that Mark is in the hand, and he'd been calling the whole way. Now, if Mark shows a winning hand or raises, then it's smooth calling the whole way. But right now, I don't know that. So I'm like, God, I think my 5s are good. You know, and it's a pretty big pot when you think about it because... You know, that 10 plus the 18 from the 6 before and then the raise. And, you know, you're looking at a good $25, $30 pot here. 30 skittle pot, whatever. And I'm like, God, I'm getting a decent amount of my money, but there's 2 over cards, a straight draw. And Scott could have raised with 8s pre-flop and had overs the whole way until the river. You know, but I really think I'm good against Scott. I think he's just riding the rush. I think I'm good. And I got the money, and I even had a raise in my hand. And I'm looking at you, and I look at Mark, and Mark is giving away nothing. And I'm like, God, Mark, if you weren't in his hand. So finally I let it go, and I'm waiting for Mark to raise or call, and Mark mucks. So I'm like, no! I wanted to get my cards out of the book because I was convinced you were bluffing me. And... sure enough, you turn over Jack 9 of hearts. You had nothing. And I was right. I was so right. But I couldn't make the call. Well, I mean, I know I totally misplayed the hand. And I'm not looking for that. I mean, I definitely should have raised, after check raised you on the flop. And I didn't. And I don't know why I didn't. Maybe because I wanted to be convinced that you were going to check the turn, then I could take it away from you or whatever. But when you fired again and Mark was in the hand still, that totally screwed up my play. So I think I was outthinking myself. I should have just check-raised you on the flop, and I didn't. So anyway, the reason we brought this hand up was because a lot of times they tell you when you read books and you talk to people, you know, it's easier to bluff one person than it is to bluff two. And for me, there's no way Scott can win unless he bets. So he played it exactly the only way he could have if he wanted to win the hand, and he played it well. And then on my end, I'm the victim of this thinking that Scott can't be bluffing because there's two of us smooth calling him the whole way. So he has to have a hand. And then the other part is that I'm thinking about Mark in the hand. And so it's not just making a bluff multi-way, but it's also you can't call a bluff multi-way because you always got to worry about the third person behind you. The only way I could have called in that situation and not worried about it was if I was in Gambit seat and he was in mine, because then he would have folded, and then I could have called you because I only have to beat one person in this bluff, you know? So it was just, to me, it had a lot of layers to it, even though it was so simple. It was like a five, you know, three-bet thing, and it just seemed like a simple hand, but when the more you think about it, there were a lot of lessons in there.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, it was a little bit perilous playing it the way I did, but at the same time, I felt like I was in control the whole time. And certainly, if I would have got played back at, you know, the cards would have hit the muck faster than Usain Bolt getting to the fried chicken. And that's because he sponsors KFC.
Yeah, I know.
Kind of what I'm going to cost myself some money by improving the show here by having a good discussion. Because this is what went into my thought process. I think, I believe I might have been on, well, no, yeah, Jack Nine, right? I raised just to see, you know.
Yeah, you raised under the gun with Jack Nine of Hearts.
But I could find out, you know, maybe represent a bigger hand, right? And then yeah. I got you guys in the blinds calling. And then after that, when, you know, both checks around, you know, I got a fire receive bet there, right?
Right.
To see what happens. And I didn't get played back yet. So, which doesn't necessarily say anything, but certainly it doesn't make my decision easy, folding, you know. So then on the turn, when I didn't get played back yet, no one took the lead in there. And I'm like, you know what? I got to fire one more time here and see whether they really don't have anything. And I didn't get played back yet again.
Yeah.
So then the river obviously missed, and I think there might have been two hearts on the board. I think I might have been having a little more confidence with the hearts.
Maybe the turn was a heart. That is the hard part for me to remember, because I had hearts in my hand, too. That's what I remember thinking, too, is glad the hearts didn't get there. So maybe there was a turn on the heart, a heart on a turn, I mean.
But so then it comes to the river, and again, you guys check to me, which at this point, you know, I know both of you well since I played with you forever. And I know you're good enough players not to to know that. I mean, how often do I fire three barrels and no limit?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got a hand and you want to get some value, you gotta put a bet in at that point, is what I was thinking. So the fact that you guys both checked means that these guys aren't excited about their hands, so firing the third barrel might work. And then, additionally, what I knew is... you know, you're a kryptonite, Chris, which you probably don't even realize. But you will now, and you'll totally brutalize me from here on out because you know it now. Is that there's no one in our home game that studies poker more than you.
Uh-huh.
You know, when we start this hand, and, you know, like, I don't remember the cards, but I know Chris will. And you remember every card in our 2 weeks later, beyond, and you get frustrated when people don't do what they should do in hand. And this I've really refined when I play 2-7 with you, because you pretty much want to get out an Uzi and slay the entire table during 2-7, because no one plays the right way. You're like, oh, how can you make that move without a deuce or a seven in your hand? Didn't you read Super System? And so I use that to my advantage when I can get into hands with you, because I know you are putting way more thought into it than I am. And if I can do something that seems a little crazy but makes sense from how you would think about it, I'm going to get you off the hand.
Yeah.
Because you'd be like, there's no way. He has to have a hand here now that he's betting. And I knew you'd be thinking that. Now, the peril in this was, of course, I had Gambit behind you.
Yeah.
So the same thing that you were worried about, I was worried about too. I'm like, I was confident that I could get you off this hand. And that's not braggy, it's just the way the hand worked. But what if Gambit has just been snowing me this entire hand, and I make this fires his bet, you fold as I know you would, and then he calls me down with what I thought you had. You know, if he would have had your hand, he would have called me there. And I don't think he showed his hand, so I don't know.
I don't know what he had. And that's the thing, too, is that he had the luxury of me getting out of the way and making that decision that he only has to beat one hand now, whereas I didn't have that. I was whipsawed, as they say, right in the middle. And I totally misplayed it. I mean, I really thought that I was going to check. I really thought I was going to be heads up with you, and then I should have check raised, and I didn't when it was the flop. And I should have. I had top pair, and you could have had a billion hands there, you know. Yeah, and
yeah,
and
it's
so,
certainly not an easy call.
Yeah, and I should have just when the flop came like that, I should have check raised, and when I didn't, I should have bet out on a turn, or I should have put a defensive bet out on the river to see exactly where I was. And then you might have let it go, because I would have been first to act. So, no, yeah, because I was small and he was big and you were, yeah. So I would have been first to act. So I mean, I totally misplayed it. But the hard part for me was not calling you when I knew you were bluffing. That was the weird thing. The one time that I caught you in a bluff, and you got to show it when I knew you were bluffing. I was so bad. There's nothing I could do about it because Gambit was behind me. That was the problem. So even more of an argument to try to get hands heads up when you can. For that reason right there alone, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, yep. Yeah. Every extra person in the hand complicates decisions by a huge factor.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But it was a lot of fun. Had a good night. And, yeah, anyway. Yeah, so don't try to bluff people three-handed, and don't try to call a bluff when you have someone behind you to act. It's not – it's could be perilous, so. Well, our hotline was ringing this week, 813-448-1120. Big news out of Ohio.
Hey guys, this is Bill from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm calling in regards of a Horseshoe Casino opening up soon, and I know there's going to be a lot of big fish there, especially in the opening. Just want to know how to play against them. Hey, you guys. Love you guys, and have a nice day.
Well, first I want to say, as a native Buckeye, how excited I am that we actually have real poker in my home state now. And obviously the Horseshoe Cleveland just opened this week. Jeremy Smith, the great manager there. The reports I'm getting from folks that were there are just absolutely packed. People actually were lined up like 2 hours before the casino even opened to get in.
Yeah, yeah. We'll probably talk about this a little bit more later, but Chicago Joe texted me, 4 hour wait, he said, to get into the Horseshoe for him.
Yeah.
So that's just massive, just to get in.
Absolutely crazy. And so the Casino Toledo is going to open here at the end of the month. Columbus, my hometown, in November. And I think the Cincinnati one will be around the same time. But so, you know, and Phil, I think it gives us a good question here. You got when you have anything like a massive amount of people trying to get into play, just by pure statistics, it reduces the quality of play, doesn't it?
I think so, but I think that if this had happened in 2005, it'd be a lot fishier than he's hoping or thinking it would be. I mean, yeah, I agree with you. I think that there's not that many good poker players in the world that kind of busy casino is going to have all quality players, but I definitely think that he's going to be surprised by the level of play that he does face. I don't think it's going to be that juicy. Is it? I don't know. I mean, I could be wrong, and I could just be totally misguessing, but there's some quality play in that area, you know, when you consider the Chicago, the ships in Indiana, and, you know, the charities in Chicago and Michigan and all that. I mean, I don't think that it's going to be just, oh, hey, there's a casino. Let's go in here about this Texas Hold'em thing. You know, I mean, I really think that there's going to be – they're there because they've been dying to play poker in their area because they had to travel all the time to play, and now they don't have to. So – yeah, I do think the sheer numbers mean that they're going to be some people who finally get to experience it for the first time. But overall, I think you're still going to have a quality level of poker there.
Well, yeah, there's certainly some talented players probably looking to do the same thing that Phil's doing here.
Yeah.
Fish in a barrel. But there is something to be said for availability of gaming. And unfortunately, this is kind of one of the arguments that works against those of us that are trying to, you know, expand gaming, whether it's online or live or anything throughout the country, is, you know, if you make it convenient to someone, they're more likely to play.
Yeah.
You know, so right now, if you were in Cleveland before the Horseshoe opened, you know, you're looking at an hour and a half drive to one of the other poker rooms. But now, it could be a 5-minute walk, depending on where you live, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to bring out people that weren't willing to make that hour and a half drive. And if they weren't willing to make that hour and a half drive, then it's a reasonable assumption to assume that they're not at the level that Phil is here in his call.
And right. And he's wondering how you play against them, a lot of fish, or how you play against them. And, I mean, I think it goes back to ABC. I mean, if they don't know what they're doing, then all you have to do is you can't be creative and you can't overthink it like I did with Scott. You know what I mean? You have to just play the hand straightforward until you get a gauge of what they think is a good hand kind of thing. And then you'll know by the way they're betting, you know, okay, they think jacks are a good hand when you have two pair or something, you know. But really in the beginning, I think it's just ABC. Obviously, you can't make a move on people who don't know what a move is. So just play straightforward, play them, and value bet them the whole way when you got a good hand.
Yeah, and, you know, Lee Childs, I think, would be perfect advice for this, and he's actually going to be on the show here in a couple weeks, so maybe you can remember to ask him about that. But I remember having a phone conversation with him not long after Black Friday last year when he started playing live a lot more because of it. Hollywood Charlestown is the closest room to his house, and very much like the Horseshoe, Cleveland, very busy. It's actually still busy more than a year after it opened. And that's what he told me. He's like, you know, hey, Scott, I don't have to get crazy. I don't have to get real creative there. I just sit there and play solid poker.
Yeah.
And the people give me their money. And so, you know, he's obviously a better one to ask than we are. And I've heard that from other people is, you know, don't waste a lot of time getting creative. Just play a good, solid game. And if the players really are weaker, which we think they are, you're going to do all right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's sound advice. And then, you know, once you fillet the fish or whatever and they're gone, and it gets down to the players that you know are pretty decent, and then you start picking up your game and referring back to the plays that, you know, in your arsenal or whatever. But in the beginning, yeah, just play them straight up and value bet. The value bet is a big thing. You know, every once in a while you have to make a hand, and then when you're in a hand with them and you know you got the best of it, it's just trying to extract the right amount of money out of them. And then really, you just got to, that's all feel. It's not something we can give you advice on. It's just something you have to feel your way through.
Yeah, and I'll say the other thing that Lee told me too is, you know, don't necessarily think the prop is going to be better at the bigger games.
Right.
You know, Lee told me that at that point he was quite happy playing the 2-5 because he knew he was going to make more money than the 2-5. He knew he could beat the 5-10 game, but why play the 5-10 game and make less money than you would in the 2-5 game? So, you know, don't let your ego get involved or get too excited about the number of or amount of money, you know. You know, if you're a good 5-10 player, you're probably going to make more money in the 2-5 in that particular setting. Or if you're a good 2-5 player, you might make more in the 1-2.
Right, absolutely. If they told you you're going to make $7,000 in the 1-2 game and you're going to make $1,000 in the 5-10, what are you going to do?
Absolutely.
You're going to play the 1-2, so don't let ego get in the way.
All right, Phil, we appreciate you calling the hotline. Remember, everybody else, call it at 813-448-1120. And we'll give you something great, like we're going to give Phil a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store.
We have a mailbag this week, too. And I'm going to give our writer here a nickname.
All right.
His nickname is going to be I'm Not From. So his name is Dan, I'm Not From England. Because every time we read him, I say this. So he's from Colorado, I believe.
Yes.
He writes in today about stereotypes. He says, I'm at a 1-2 game at the Monte Carlo in Vegas in December. First hand he's dealt literally is King-King. A guy in early position pops it to 10. I re-raise to 30. An old guy in the big blind starts counting out chips and puts 100 out. The first guy says, I have to call you, and calls. It's my decision now. This old guy came in the same time I did. He looked exactly like the kind of old guy nit we all know at the table. I had no information on him other than that. Ultimately, I folded because he's an old nitty guy. I folded because of a stereotype. I have to admit, it would have been a tougher fold if he wasn't an old guy. So he says he remembers Jay Greenspan relying on stereotypes against an Asian player in his book Hunting Fish and making the right move because he assumed the Asian player was being ultra-aggressive. He said something like, using stereotypes as a part of your thinking, however distasteful they may be, can be useful. How often should we use stereotypes as part of our decision-making process? He says it worked in this case. The old man did have ace-ace. The other player, by the way, had ace-ten suited. Hey, I was playing at the Monte Carlo? And lost his whole stack. The first thing I'll say, I don't know if you had something prepared or not, but as I remember just a few months ago that we had a column by Mike Wolf, one of our strategy columnists, talking about this very same thing, where there are certain things that when you're at a table, especially when you're first with these people and your first impressions of them, that you just take for granted and you have to assume. And sometimes that's what he does to get a baseline on people, and then they have to prove him differently. So if I'm going to use any stereotypes when I'm playing, it's going to be in the early going and right away, and not like he did here, and not, you know, 50 hands in, because I should know him by then. So if I'm going to do it, I would do it in the beginning only and not later on. So I don't know if it weighs in on my process thinking when, you know, we're 50 hands in or an hour into tournament play or something, and I don't say, oh, well, he's Asian, maybe he's just gambling with me. You know, I don't think like that. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely love this letter. And I told Dan this, and we had a good conversation going back and forth. The first thing, I kind of want to answer it from a poker perspective and then from a non-poker perspective, which actually affects the poker perspective. From the poker perspective, we all know poker is a game of information, right?
Yeah.
And it's incomplete information. So any information you can gather to help you make a better decision, you absolutely have to use. So when he asked, you know, should we use stereotypes as part of our decision-making process? Absolutely. If you don't, in fact, actually, I think it's reckless. You know, if you let yourself at the poker table, mind you, at the poker table, get PC in your mind and say, oh, this is offensive to me to think that this old guy's a nit, so I'm not going to play it like that. He would have lost a stack there.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, he had I had to edit this letter a little bit. He had picked up on a couple other tells, but the base idea was he folded because this guy was an old nitty guy, and his stereotype of old guys is that they're nitty, right?
Right.
So I do think it's absolutely reckless to not use the whatever information you have at the table. Now, I did make the point to him, too, about that using that there's a big difference for me between using that information internally and externally. So, you know, if you have this discussion in your mind and it stays in your mind, that's one thing. But if you fold your cards and after the hand's over, like, yeah, guy, I would have called you, but you're an old nitty guy. That's crossing a line, right? Now, in terms of overall thing, this is the good conversation I was having with Dan, is that because he mentions how distasteful this would be part of the Jay Greenspan thing, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what affects a lot of us, because most of us are good people by nature, right? And we don't want to be someone that is accused of stereotyping or being offensive. Oh, you just did that because he's a woman, or you just did that because he's black, or, you know, whatever, you know? But be brutally honest, stereotypes are based on at least a kernel of truth, right?
Yeah.
No one makes up a stereotype that has no basis on anything.
Right.
And it's because of a conglomeration of information. Now, I think where we get where this gets squishy is that the stereotype has to be based on information that you have witnessed. Right?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, where it gets these debates happen in our society is because these stereotypes are based on what other people tell you you should believe about someone, right?
Mm.
So here's my example. You know, literally in the last 3 weeks, I have seen three comics do a joke about how bad Asians are at driving. You know, Asians are terrible drivers, and everybody, guffaws, right? Of all the Asian friends I have, not one of them have I noticed anything about their driving that's out of the norm.
Right.
All
right? Right.
So if I would let myself believe that Asians are terrible drivers, it would be based on what somebody's telling me to believe, not what I personally witnessed. And that's a real problem, I think. And that's the same thing at the table, then, is, you know, obviously what everybody talks about is Asian players are aggressive, ultra-aggressive gambling. until you've witnessed that yourself, then I think you're being a little damaging in accepting somebody else's thoughts on it. And that's what I think it comes down to with stereotypes. Stereotypes are not inherently offensive. They're only offensive when you don't think for yourself.
And the other thing in this hand, too, is if you think about it, it doesn't even have to be a nit. A person raised, you re-raise, and then he re-raises. Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, it's not even have to be an old person. It can be any person. That's a pretty big hand, probably. And, yeah, me, if I'm admitting it, I'm probably calling or getting it all in with kings, because what are the odds the one hand is out there on the first hand I sit down? So I'm probably getting it in. It's a monumental fold on his part. And so I don't know how he got away from that, but in strict poker,
because he's an offensive sense. Stereotyper. That's how he got away.
But really, strict poker logic tells you this guy has a huge hand. It could have been queens. It could have been ace king. But your spidey senses were working, and you got out. And it might have been not just the fact that he was an old nit. I mean, it could have been, like you said, that this is a pretty big raise. When it went from raise and re-raise, so he's got to be telling you something with that. He's not a bluffer at that point. And so, yeah, but I agree what you had to say there. I mean, I know what you're saying. And, like you said, you got to get a baseline of people quickly in the poker game. And when your whole stack is put on the line in the first hand, you're going to revert to something. And I'm sure his general practice is that the older the player, generally the tighter they are. And whatever reason that is, that's what he's come across as he's read and experienced himself and made a fold, and it was a good one.
And I think what's particularly difficult about this, particularly for somebody like us that do a lot of traveling, is, you know, if you find yourself in a new poker market where the player base is completely different from where you are used to playing, you kind of feel this internal pressure to apply these stereotypes, like I said, other people have. I mean, you know, when you go out to California, I mean, here in Florida, I might have one Asian guy at my table every time I sit down.
Right.
At most. You go out there, and it's five or six, usually.
Right.
You know, here in Florida, it's a little different because we got some older population here. But you go to, like, Mississippi, I know I'm going to play against probably the median age is going to be older there than here. So it just depends on where you play, and it's tough to be plopped down in those settings with no baseline at all and have to adjust pretty quickly. Particularly when you get a hand like this on the first hand, I mean, you don't got any information to work on, so you gotta work on the best thing you can. So.
Yep.
I certainly don't think Dan was wrong here, and Dan, we appreciate you mailing that to us. By mailing, I mean sending it to the interwebs at podcast@anyupmagazine.com, and everybody else do the same thing, and you're gonna win something great like Dan won today: a deck of J Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anyup. Pick up your own decks in the Anyup store at antiupstore.com.
Seriously, what are you doing over there? You're making a lot of noise. Are you like tapping the microphone or something? You're driving me crazy.
No, I'm just standing here.
You're not moving at all?
Nope.
Okay, call the floor. This is a very interesting call the floor. So much so that Jody had to enlist the help of other people to see what they thought.
Yeah.
And this one actually made our magazine this month. So you'll see the same thing there. But we recognize that not everybody who listens to the show reads a magazine and vice versa, so we want to make sure every Anyup Nation member gets the benefit of this knowledge. So this comes from Dave Bloomberg, almost always contributing every week to our show, and very interesting. It comes via email. It says, I was in the big blind for 300. There were multiple limpers, and I looked down at ace-king. So I pulled back the 300 I had in, and without saying a word, tossed in a 1,000 value chip. The guy on my left immediately went all in, and everybody else folded just as quickly, and I called. After all this significant action had taken place, one player raised the question of whether I had raised or done an oversized chip call. With all the action that had taken place, and since neither I nor the all-in player objected, we just continued. We discussed it further, and I looked up the TDA rules. Here's what they say in Rule 38, oversized chip betting. Anytime when facing a bet or a blind, placing a single oversized chip in the pot is a call if a raise isn't first verbally declared. When not facing a bet, placing an oversized chip in the pot without declaration is a bet of the maximum for the chip. When we saw this, those at the table generally agreed that I was not facing a bet because my chips were in the pot and there was no raise to me. Therefore, by pulling back my 300 and placing an oversized chip into play, I was indeed raising to 1,000. I know that, of course, to avoid this situation in the future, all I have to do is say raise before throwing out the chip, but I still would be interested to see if I interpret this rule correctly.
Yes, actually, and this is what I like about our listeners. They know instinctively how to avoid the situation in the future.
Right.
But it's always good to know the rules. So what's fascinating about this is Jody gave us an answer, and then because he loves talking about this to his other folks in the tournament business, he talked about it, and he immediately sent an email, hey, hold on.
Yeah.
I'm getting some different views on this. And he refined his answer, and then even one of the persons that he consulted on this actually met out in Pepperville on this last trip and mentioned that he loved this. So we got a lot of good advice here for you. But this is what Jody said. The situation is one that definitely could go either way based on who is making the decision. An argument in favor of making this a raise. After several days of thought, I decided to ask my professional friends. It was much more controversial than I could have imagined. At first, I was in agreement with making this a raise. My good friend Matt Savage made a very valid point that since it is unclear what the action is, we should go with the smaller amount, making it a call. He also tweeted about it, and the response was split. After all this, here's what I've decided my position is in this situation. Once the player pulls the 300 out of the pot, the action to him is 300. Placing a single chip in the pot is a call by a technical interpretation of the rule. That said, if other players had already acted on the attempted raise, I would rule the raise should stand. Allowing the big blind to take back the 1,000 and leave 300 in the pot after others have called, folded, or raised could open a really big door to take shots at less experienced players. Please bear in mind that this could be avoided by a simple verbal statement of raise or call. This is definitely something you may see different rulings on and is a great example of why rule number one might come into play, which allows four people to do what is best for the game on a case-by-case basis. Perhaps this should be discussed at the next TDA summit. Although I don't believe a new rule is necessary, it may be helpful to add to Rule 38 for clarification. Thank you for sending this one in. It's been very fun and stimulating for this poker rules nerd. I don't know if Jody's a nerd. but, you know, one of the people he talked to was Dave Lamb, who is the tournament coordinator at the Great Peppermill Room out in Reno. And like I said, I was out there visiting, and Dave bent my ear on this a little bit and sent up a follow-up. And because what we talked about there is what he sent me, which is the only time we should allow a player to handle chips in the pot is in split games where the bets remain in front of the player. Each player can be allowed to correct bets, call raises, etc., because those chips will only need to be verified if an opponent scoops. Do not let players make change from the pot. And how he explained it to me is he doesn't want players messing with the pot.
Yeah.
Once you put your chips out there, they are no longer your chips. Now, obviously, you make the exception of a split pot game where you're speeding it up, you're making change, and it can be verified. If somebody's reaching into the pot and grabbing chips out, and by the pot he means anything that's been pushed out, obviously, you know, our hero here is not reaching into that big pot in the middle and pulling out chips. But it's akin to the same thing, he says. You know, that should not be allowed. The dealer should say, hey, that's my job, I'll make change for you later on. And or you know, whatever the case is, and that would have probably avoided the situation as well.
Yeah, it's weird because, you know, you can't. If the chip's in front of him and it's in reaching distance, and he does it, the dealer couldn't stop it, and you can't pull it and throw it in the pot yet because you still.
Well,
have
no, but
your
the dealer
action,
can
right?
say, "Hey, whoa!"
You know, no, I know, but he grabbed it
retroactively. Absolutely.
You know, yeah.
I mean, sure, we should put like an electronic charge on the chip.
We should. As soon as it hits past the line, that's like an electronic field that'll zap you if you touch anything in there. That's the next big thing. Screw the holograms. We're going with electric field fences on poker tables.
Oh, it'd be great for TV, wouldn't it? but, you know, I understand what Dave's point is here. And this is one of the things that frustrates me. And, you know, we're getting ready to do our next Reader's Choice survey. And one of my favorite questions is, oh, what annoys you at the table? And I didn't really put this in there. But as weird as it sounds, I get annoyed about people who think they're being helpful at the table.
Yeah.
All right. You know, sure. I mean, there's nothing wrong with trying to be helpful, but there's a reason we have a professional dealer at the table. And by helping he or she out, and helping is in quotes here, sometimes you're hurting. And this is not maybe an example of that, but I don't know if we've already talked about it on the show, or maybe I saw this from somewhere else, but one of the things that that I read somewhere is that a dealer, you know, when you do the dealer move button, or button move dealer, you're just being helpful. Sometimes that can mess up the dealers because they have a, you know, they're trained to do things in a sequence.
Yeah.
You know, they're trained to verify the hand, you know, kill the hand, push the pot, move the button, drop the rake. And so when you're doing something out of that norm, it throws them off. And even if a mistake is not made on the button, a mistake might be made somewhere else. So it's best just to let the dealer do his or her job, right?
Right.
And this is one of those cases, too. You know, it's tough with these big chips. And so I the takeout, which Dave obviously mentioned, is, you know, hey, I just need to be verbal. If you be verbal, no problem. But, you know, at that point, if you find yourself grabbing a chip, then you absolutely need to be verbal at that point to avoid the situation.
So, again, it got called. Now, he was the big blind at 300, or that's what I'm trying to remember.
Big blind at 300.
Right, so he was a big blind at 300, and it was his option, right? It gets to him, and it's his option. The dealer says option. When he pulls a 300 back and he throws a 1,000 chip in, he's obviously making a raise there because his option, not going to exchange the 300.
Well, I wouldn't say it's obvious. I mean,
no, he's already got 300 out there. If he's already got 300, it's option. He's pulling his money back and throwing in a bigger chip. He's not doing it to exchange the rate. He's raising.
It's highly likely that's what he's trying to do, but by the strict interpretation of the rule, it's not necessarily that because he didn't verbalize raise.
Right.
I know what you're trying to get at.
Yeah, because the interpretation of the rule is when there's no money out there yet and you throw
again,
a chip out.
I mean, the reason we had the TDA rules is to avoid ambiguity.
Yeah.
Other than rule number one, which is completely ambiguous.
Right.
And that's really what we're shooting at. You're in this specific example, yeah, you're right. I don't think anybody's going to question that what he's doing is a raising. But the reason we're talking about it, the reason we have rules, is to remind players not to do it because there might be a situation different from this one, but similar, where it's not so clear what's going on. And if everybody acts properly, then you avoid that problem at that situation. I mean, in the end, this one didn't really end up being a problem because, you know, the guy wanted to go all in. David obviously wanted to raise. Everybody else got out. And, you know, although I guess there might be a case to be made because he was the big blind, right? I guess there'd be a big case to be made that the other players in the pod would have seen a flop for the price they paid, right?
Well, the other thing, too, is that...
Raise, because the all-in wouldn't have been able to raise all-in at that point.
Yeah,
because
the guy on his left immediately went all-in, so that means that he interpreted it as a raise, and that's how this happened, because otherwise it would have been wrap the table and do a flop if he had...
Right, but you know what I'm saying is, if you're in a middle position and you had called the 300, had David not been able to raise, the under-the-gun player would not have been able to fall in,
right.
And you would have seen the flop for 300.
Right.
The way it worked out, you ended up having to commit a call the all-in this way. So it was actually a pretty decisive thing. Of course, at this point, the hand ended before anybody mentioned it, so it didn't really matter. But, you know, again, as everything else it comes down to, just say what you mean.
Yeah.
The problem is almost... 99% of problems are resolved if you actually speak up.
Yep, that's like your favorite thing to say when we do our Poker 101 is let these people understand, you know, say what you want to do. Verbal is binding, so that way you don't have to worry about string raises or you know, putting too much money over the line and having to commit it all. If you say what you want to do first, you'd never have these problems.
Yep. Of course, no one ever listens to me. All right, David, obviously you've got some recent swag, so we're not going to send you anything. But everybody else, email your call to floor questions. We love getting them. Joey loves answering them. Email them to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we might send you something cool like a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com. All right, when I was out in California last week, I talked about how absolutely hilarious our Los Angeles ambassador, Dave Palm, is. And he had me cackling in the car about something, and I told him, hey, remind me so I can put on the show. He totally forgot. Let me down, but he ended up calling the hotline, so it's a week late, but so I think it's pretty funny. So let's listen to his clip.
Hey there, it's Dave from Redondo Beach. the LA ambassador, and I'm listening to this week's podcast, and I forgot, I told Scott that I would call in and remind him to talk about the cash game strategy of implied tilt odds. He and I had a good laugh about it. That's it. Have a good day.
All right, now I know you said you heard this from somewhere else, and that's fine, but it was the first time I heard it, so I'm going to cackle.
All right.
Implied tilt odds. I love it. I love that concept, that knowing that if you get some, if you actually hit, not only do you win the pot, but you get somebody on this raging Phil Hellmuth Jr. thing, and you're able to make more money off of it, and factoring that into your calculations. It's a hilarious thing, but it's also very smart, I think, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you guys try to use that against me all the time, but I don't blow up anymore, so it doesn't work, so I've been reaping the benefits of that lately.
Oh, man. All right, well, as we mentioned, we are getting on the road, and we have lots of opportunities to meet us. You know, Chris, people can say a lot of things about us, and I know they do, and often to our face, which is even more fun. But I don't think they can say that we're not accessible.
That's right.
We get out there, we want to, you know, meet you guys where you live, and, you know, we try to respond to all your emails and phone calls. But I really look forward to meeting folks. We've got plenty of opportunities coming up, including some new ones that we haven't been pimping. So
that's right.
You kick us off with Daytona.
Yeah, this Sunday I'll be in Daytona, and my dance card is filling up. I've got all these people saying they're going to come say hi to me and talk to me. So get there early. And also, we had heard that there's only about 83 seats left out of 600. So make sure you pre-register at deepstackcharityclassic.com. If you plan on going and haven't really signed up for it yet or paid for it yet, it's the DeepSec Charity Classic that we support every year and at Daytona Beach Kennel Club. And I will be there with bells on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to sell out. And that 83 number was on Monday, and it's already Thursday, probably even Friday by the time people hear this. So don't make that drive unless you pre-registered.
Right.
All right, Minneapolis on May 27th. We're all going to be taking a St. Paul Saints game at 3 p.m. Yesterday was the deadline to let us know, but we're going to extend it here. Just let us know. We haven't figured out exactly what we're doing, whether we're going to get one of those little group areas or just GA. But if you're coming, send us an email, podcast@aniamagazine.com, so we know. And then after the game, we're going to head over to Canterbury Park and just get an impromptu cash game going. And we'll be there around 7:30 or so.
I love this impromptu stuff.
Well, you know, I guess the point is we don't have anything. We don't have a table dedicated.
Right, right.
So we're going to get there. We're going to figure out how many people are there and what we want to play. And let the money fly at that point. A couple days later, I'll be in Chicago. We're going to be meeting at 8 p.m. at Horseshoe Hammond, also for an impromptu cash game at that point.
And then don't forget, now we're going to be in Vegas, and we got a little more details this time. June 27th, we're going to crash Karina Jett's weekly 6-12 mixed game that starts at 6 p.m. out there. We may not play that game, we may not play that level, who knows, but we'll get a table with something else going. It's at the MGM Grand, we'll do a sort of a consensus, and if people want to play mixed games, maybe we will play that game, or maybe we'll make it a different, you know, 4-8 or something, or even a 2-4 or 3-6, who knows. 3-6 seems to be pretty popular with our meetups lately. We'll see what's going on. It's going to be at the MGM Grand. Don't forget, we're there the whole week, June 25th to the 29th, and the 27th is when the meetup will be at the MGM Grand.
Yeah, Karina Jett's such a fun person to be around, too, so I'm kind of looking forward to it. I'm going to get in that game, I think, if there's a seat, but obviously after I get busted in that game, I'm going to gear down to whatever games are going on, but looking forward to folks. And that's our birthday week, too. We actually will turn Annie Up Magazine. We'll turn 4 years old.
Wow.
That week. So maybe somebody will buy us a cake. all right, and a couple new dates added. Chris is going to fly home after Vegas. Boat for a little longer. I'm going to head out to New Mexico, Albuquerque, on June 30th. Not sure we have anything. Nothing solid there, but if folks email me and let me know that they want to have a meetup, we'll try to get a cash game going one of the casinos in the Albuquerque area on June 30th. And then from there, I'm going to fly up to Denver, and we will be having a meetup at Isle Blackhawk either July 1st or July 2nd. That's a Sunday or Monday. Email us at podcast@aniamagazine.com. Let me know what night of the week is better for you. and we'll pick one here relatively soon so you know you can plan. And looking forward to seeing you in the Denver area.
Also, our cruises, two cruises, antiupmagazine.com/cruise, August 27th out of Port Canaveral. That one is going to be packed. We've just announced a bunch of giveaways, too. You know, Tampa Bay Downs and Dover Downs. And Dover Downs one, I believe, is for the Baltimore cruise, which is November 10th. So, you know, we got a lot of good stuff coming your way. Just be sure to go to our website and check it out. We're going to be everywhere.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's see what's stacking up on our Antiup news desk this week.
All right, 2.5 years after approved by voters, Ohio saw its first casino open this week. The Horseshoe Cleveland opened to long lines of crowds, and early reports were that the WSOP-branded poker room had hours-long waits for seats. Hollywood Casino Toledo opens later this month, and casinos in Columbus and Cincinnati are slated to open late this year or early next. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, Chicago Joe was on site, and it was just absolutely madhouse.
This reminds me of the time when all of the mailmen and bankers were off for the day on a Monday, and I happened to stumble upon the Foxwoods Poker Room after an hour-long drive there, and I had an eight-hour wait to get on any table.
Yep.
And everyone's telling me, oh, slip him a 20, give him an Andrew Jackson, he didn't move you up on the list. And I'm thinking Chicago Joe probably should have done that four-hour wait, just walked up to some guard and be like, hey, man, here's a Finsky, let me in.
Chicago Joe is a man of strong ethics.
Oh, yeah, but everyone else is telling me to slip somebody 20 bucks.
Yeah. Hey, if you want to jump off the cliff, too, you little lemming, you can, but someone's a little smarter than that.
All right, at a gaming policy committee meeting this week, Nevada Gaming Control Board Chairman Mark Liparelli said online poker licenses would be issued in the next 30 to 60 days, with sites expected to launch intrastate poker in about 6 to 8 months after licenses are issued. What do we think about this?
Yeah, so we're looking, 8, 10 months, maybe a little longer before we'll see online poker in Nevada. And again, this is going to be intrastate, so it's only going to be for Nevada residents. So, I don't know how, like I think with any of these state things, I don't know necessarily how successful they're going to be on their own. The key will be whether other states join up later on, and then they can combine their efforts into a bigger player base. But if nothing else, at least what we're doing with this Nevada is getting some of the titans of the poker industry, both the brick and mortar companies and online companies, working together and getting stuff established. So you have frameworks ready for any state after that wants to get involved. So pretty big development, I think.
And one of the things I don't want the show to be any longer than it already is because it's already too long, but I often hear the argument from you and other pundits that say that the liquidity is key and you need enough players to sustain it. But I'm just curious about really what kind of overhead. I mean, these sites made billions of dollars for a reason, because there's not that much overhead and they're raking every single hand. So do they need that many players to be successful or to be in the black?
Yeah, you're right. Success is defined differently, I think. Uh-huh. You're right. I think there is, no one's going to have to mortgage their house to run one of these sites. You
right.
know, they're going to make money. What I consider success is well accepted by the player base. And my feeling is I know how players think, just because all the emails and phone calls and people that I talk to on the street, they're not, as odd as it sounds, that they're not going to go into this thinking that it's going to be different than PokerStars or Full Tilt or what they previously played. And it's going to be very different than that. I mean, the look of it, the feel of it, all that stuff is not going to be all that different. But there's just not going to be a lot of tables.
Right.
Or at least not as many tables as they're used to on these big sites until, you can open up to at least a couple states, if not the whole country, and then at that point the world. I mean, think about it, PokerStars and Full Tilt, those are worldwide companies.
Yeah.
And obviously those two were so big that, you could find a pot limit 5-card draw game whenever you wanted. I don't think we necessarily need that in these things. But, you do need to be able to find a good number of no-limit games, I would think, to replicate that.
Right.
So some people are going to be very excited just to play at all, even if there's only four people on there at any time, and that's fine. But I think the masses really are, they're, you know, particularly on forums, because we know how vitriolic people get on forums. Mm-hmm. You know, not just poker forums, but any forum. You go to, you know, Travel Advisor. Oh my gosh, they didn't have toothpaste at my hotel. What an abomination! And you know, I think we're going to get that. You know, hey, I went on there, and there was only 60 no limit games going. What a joke! And that's just going to feed other people. You know what I mean? So yeah. That's where that's my level of success. It's not so much a financial level. It's a, you know, perception level on part of players.
Yeah, and of course they're just doing this to get in and get it running and going and get out the Absolutely. Kinks and be prepared for when federal filing happens, then they can launch nationally and be way ahead of everybody else. So
exactly.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think that it's only going to be a good thing when you see that running and successful, and other states are going to jump on board and it's going to push it. So, good for them.
Absolutely. All right, and finally, some of Hollywood's biggest stars won't face a trial after settling out of court to repay money won in a high-stakes Hollywood poker game from a financial advisor since convicted of fraud. Those celebrities agreed to pay back $1.75 million of the approximately $5 million the advisor said he lost in the games. And that money will go to the victims of his fraud.
Oh, man. All right.
You know,
I mean, it's good that the people who have been frauded by this loser is getting the money. So that's good. But I'd like to know more details.
Well, you know, here's the bottom line is that if you play poker in a licensed, regulated environment, I'm not saying there won't be problems, but there's far fewer problems than when you play in a non-regulated environment. And, you know, had these high-stakes games would have happened at the Commerce or Hollywood Park, these celebrities would not have had to pay back a dime. But because they opened themselves up to whether, hey, was this game legal or not? Was that a legal debt or not? That's how they end up losing on this.
Yeah.
You know, it had nothing really to do with anything else.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you know, that's what happens.
All right, well, we get to complete an O'Malley's move this week. Very exciting. I always love when we can do this and talk about it a little bit. So we'll refresh our memory right now with part one, and then we'll come back with our thoughts.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a 1-2 No Limit Hold'em home game. The play is fairly solid with two maniacs. The table is 10-handed. We bought in for 300 and currently have 375. The end of the gun calls, the end of the gun plus 1 calls, the MP1 folds, MPs 2 and 3 both call, the hijack folds, the cutoff and button call, and we're in the small blind with ace of spades, king of diamonds. Yikes. With so many people in the hand, we're in a tough situation. But we've got to thin the field. We make it $25 to go. We wouldn't mind taking this down now, but we at least want to get to heads up. It might be an overbet, but it's worth it. Everyone folds except the two MPs, who also happen to be the two maniacs. We have the MP2 covered by about 100, but the MP3 has us covered by about 300. The flop comes king of spades, jack of spades, 9 of hearts. We have to bet this. There's about $80 in the pot, and we want to make the draws pay. We bet $60, and both players call. The turn is the 8 of hearts. We really have no idea where we stand. The pot is about 260, and we're first to act. What do we do?
All right, well, you know, once again, I think we find ourselves here with just top. We're out of position against two maniacs. Nothing about this is good for me.
I know.
I just don't like the spot at all. There's going to be another hand coming up, and that's what I keep telling myself. There's going to be another hand, and let's push our edges when we have a real edge. So, you know, here's the thing. We did our best to take this thing down pre-flop. We tried to get on the flop. Chris Kassenzen is his hand, so we can't try to get on the turn. I think now it's time to do what we do to control the size of the pot. You know, maniacs usually like to come alive here on the turn after smooth calling the flop. So I'm not going to give them an opportunity to raise me here. I'm going to check, and despite the danger of giving a free card on this draw-heavy board, you know, I'm fine checking and reassessing based on what kind of bet I face on this one. And if I don't get a bet, depending on what the river card is.
So what you're saying is I need to be a maniac from now on when I'm on your left.
That would be a different persona for you, absolutely.
Well, I'm with you on this one. It's really hard to imagine where
ahead. No, don't say that.
Yeah, I know. As much as I hate giving up the lead in the hand with top-top, this turn's a very scary card and screams that we are behind. I check to see how bad the ensuing carnage will be. How does that sound?
Ensuing carnage. It sounds like a band at the high school prom, doesn't it?
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, ensuing carnage!
You know, they have like one original song that totally sucks, and then they totally butcher
all the covers.
Covers, yeah.
All right, let's hear part two.
Hello again. We check. As bad as it might sound, there is just no way we're making another stab at this pot with only top top and two maniacs. The MP2 shoves for roughly 190, and the MP3 calls. The pot is huge, but we can't fathom a situation where we're ahead of both maniacs. We muck. The MP2 turns over King of Clubs, 10 of Clubs. We had him dominated. But the MP3 shows 10 of Spades, 7 of Diamonds, for a turned Jack High straight. The river is a blank. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, make sure you have some ammunition before you start firing at a maniac. I'll see you on the felt.
Yep, about what I thought.
Yeah.
You know, to me, firing again here is akin to filling a bucket with a hole in it up again, you know. I'm going to give a good, quote-unquote, move here to O'Malley.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sort of wiping my brow and saying, our read was spot on, and we saved ourselves some cheddar. So I think the people will disagree. I think they'll think that they probably should have shoved here or whatever. But in the end, it was a read on his part, and he knew the players well enough that that card probably hurt him, and he was way behind. So good move.
Yeah, there's a good discussion going on about this on the forum right now, and I think it was universal that you needed to bet big or shove here, which is, you know, polar opposite of what we said. So, you know, it just shows that there's different ways of playing it. You know, not results oriented. Our way saved us money here. Their way would have cost them money. Well, this particular hand, but. Long term, I think it's a good discussion to have about whether you and I were too weak here, or whether the folks in the forum are too confident.
Yeah.
But just definitely join in that conversation at anyupmagazine.com/forum.
Well, a few weeks back, Scott, you had an awesome idea. You seen a story that was talking about scenes and movies about gambling and non-gambling and all that, and we talked a little bit about it. And but since we're a poker show, you said, "Hey, let's refine the list a little bit and get poker scenes, our favorite poker scenes from non-poker movies, or at least non-gambling, but for the most part, non-poker movies." And then we asked some of our listeners via Twitter and Facebook and on here as well to help us out, give us some ideas, and we got a pretty impressive list. I was very happy with the list overall. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, and you know, I mentioned this on Fifth Street Radio this week when I was on there. You would think that there's a massive body of scenes to choose from for this thing, and you know, I think when I got done compiling the ones that were suggested that were actually movies, we had some people suggesting all kinds of TV clips, but you know,
right.
There's only so much radar we could have on the show, right? you know, I think we had like 8. And then I just kind of did some random Google searching, and I picked up a couple more. So really, you know, I think we ended up with, 10 maybe on this list, 9, 10 on this list?
Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear which ones we missed that were actually decent.
Well,
because I don't know how many more actually exist, at least of popular movies that people will remember when you mention. Like, for example, we'll mention Cool Hand Luke here. Everybody, oh, yeah, I remember that one. But, you know, there might have been something in some movie called, you know, Rhinestone or something.
Right.
That no one's ever seen, but...
Well, one of the things that I left off this list that I knew about, but I knew I couldn't find audio about it and whatever, but if somebody wants to read the story, it's really good. A Streetcar Named Desire, there's a great scene in there with a radio being thrown out a window, and these women keep, you know, cackling at these guys in this game, and you know, Marlon Brando's getting more and more ticked off, and it's really... It's a real stress-filled sort of type of scene. And our good friend Shortstack Seamus, who writes the Hard Boiled Poker blog, he did a nice little write-up on this a while back, but I couldn't get the audio for it, and I wasn't sure if a lot of people actually had seen this movie and or whatever, but that was one that I didn't have on the list here. It's something that you probably should see, and if you're anything, just check out his blog and search for it. He did a real nice little write-up on it. So there's one of those scenes that is definitely not a poker movie. It had a good poker scene in it, and a very, very high-intensity kind of thing. But it was more about the women aggravating these guys than it was about poker, so I didn't put it on the list. One thing you find about our list is Paul Newman makes two appearances in it, which I think he's the only one that actually makes more than one appearance on our list, which is kind of cool. Yeah. You know, of course, everyone remembers The Sting and poker in there, and the scene is pretty long. So the first thing we'll say is that, to me, the whole scene is based on Robert Shaw making quads, and we see Newman's hand, and Newman's hand is not as good as quads, but when he puts the cards down, he's got quads. He's got quad jacks, and it's like, or he had quads, right? How did that go? I can't remember.
I believe he had quad threes, and we should say here before we start that we're going to have some audio clips of some of these hands. But not all of them.
Right.
This is one that we don't have just because it didn't work well as an audio hand. You actually had to see it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I believe he started with quad threes. And the setup here was that the Robert Shaw character, he had one of his little sidekicks rigged the deck here. And Paul Newman was rigging the rig deck, in a sense.
Yeah.
And so they got all kinds of money involved. And when he thought he was fleecing Paul Newman, he was actually getting fleeced himself. And you mentioned kind of in our show notes here that do we really want to perpetuate the stereotype of poker players as cheaters? And I'll say, you know, hey, that stereotype's only based on what you've seen yourself. but this is actually a cheater cheating a cheater.
Yeah.
That changes things, doesn't it?
Yeah, a little bit, I guess. Still cheating, though. But yeah, you're right. It's quad threes, and I think Shaw has quad tens or nines, and then
nines,
and then that's what it was. And Newman ends up showing quad jacks and taking all the money or whatever. And so it's a classic scene. It's on a train or something, right?
Yeah, it's on a train. Yeah. And you know, I'll say this Sting was like what in the 70s or 80s it came out.
Yeah.
70s. And I'm going to blame this movie because of this scene. Encourage all of these insane royal flush over straight flush scenes in movies that we've seen ever since that movie came out decades ago.
No, I disagree with you.
Absolutely, because, I mean, come on, quads over quads when it really should have been quads over quads too, so there's three quads between two people. Come on.
Oh, come on. Come on, Cincinnati kid. Straight flush and five card stud against aces full.
All right. You might.
Which was way earlier than this movie.
Okay. All
right. All right. There you go. But what we do have for you, Paul Newman makes our list a second time here, at the suggestion of the Bard himself, Mike Faso. I think via Twitter, told us we need to have the hand from Cool Hand Luke. So here we go. Let's listen to that clip, and then we'll talk about it a little bit.
Man, cuter. I'm beat down.
Kick
it back a bar.
Kick it back a bar.
I see you, buck.
And back a bar.
Oh, that's a way to
kick a buck.
Damn. Don't look at me, motherhead.
Well, come on. What you gonna do? Play like a coconut? You got to call him, didn't
you? Look, I know he's got a pair of kings. Then I have to stuff up my nose.
Well, you still gotta call him anyway.
But you gotta bring him.
You gotta look at him.
The man's got kings. Get your tail out.
Yeah.
Now you got. You wanna see him?
Yeah.
Right there. One, two, three, four, five.
Yeah.
Oh.
Mic'd up, right?
He beat you at nothing. Just like today when he kept coming back at me with nothing.
Yeah, well, sometimes nothing can be a real cool hand.
Kick a buck.
I love it.
I love it.
In the home game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's going to be a kick a skittle.
After I saw this, I thought to myself, whatever happened to one card to a hand? George Kennedy turns over Newman's cards, too. I'd be like screaming, floor! Classic scene.
See, Paul Newman, just he's got that cool confidence that you lack.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was able to internalize that, not flip out. But, you know, from a poker perspective, though, I mean, we're laughing about the one person to a hand. But, you know, this is the problem in a poker arena when somebody's talking about that. Because what do? You can't stop him in the middle of hand and say, hey, one person per hand. Because you're weak, you don't want him talking about it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I love the sometimes nothing can be real Cool Hand. I hadn't seen Cool Hand Luke still happen, but I saw this click. I would have loved to use that against you in the home game.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be on the lookout for that now. Overwhelmingly, pretty much the most dominant one that came to us was Tombstone.
Yeah.
And as you wrote here, it's always good to add insult to injury by sending a verbal jab to somebody you beat. And Doc Holliday sets the standard. Let's give a listen.
Oops. What is that now? The 12 hands in a row, Holliday? Son of a bitch, nobody's that lucky.
Why, Ike, whatever do you mean?
Take it easy, boys.
Maybe poker's just not your game, Mike. I know. Let's have a spelling contest. I thought about just ring your scurvy down.
You know, I was on my 8th grade spelling team.
You were?
Yeah, shocking, I know. I couldn't spell stalactite, and apparently by spell check here, I still can't spell it.
You can't spell it, and you can't say it.
It's stalactite. But you know what? I think I could take Doc here.
You could take him?
I'm pretty sure he wants to have a spelling contest. I'll throw down right now. You know, he's not about lucky. Luck? What, did the same 10 players make the final table of the World Series every year? What, are they the luckiest people in the world? No! It's not luck, this is skill.
Oh, man. I just have one question. How did Val Kilmer not win an Oscar for this role? I mean, at least for makeup. Do you remember the makeup he wore? It was just all pale because he's so sick. But he was awesome in this role. Absolutely awesome.
Yeah, and you know, the best part of putting this list together is reminding me of some of the holes in my video library. And I have not yet seen Tombstone either. So I'm.
Oh my God, you're crazy.
Cool Hand Luke and Tombstone maybe to my airline flights coming up here.
Get yourself some Star Wars too, will you?
Yeah, I've seen all the Star Wars. Take it or leave it. all right, so a lot of people suggested Ocean's 11, and we don't have any audio here about it for this one. But I gotta say, this is probably my least favorite of them. Am I being too harsh on it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's some cute parts in it, like deal to your left. I mean, to me, I thought he was talking to you, to be honest, because telling somebody how to deal. And then Topher Grace gets all reds and everybody's laughing and stuff. So there's a lot of little clips in that scene. If you haven't seen it, you know, little things that were kind of cute in it and kind of funny. But overall, the whole scene was just too long to play here. And I don't know if it ranks in the top, like the list that we're playing here, you know, but it was worth mentioning. And the other thing too is, even though it's, we were saying a non-poker movie, but I mean, it was just so weird to think of it as non because it's gambling and casinos and everything, you know.
Absolutely.
So yeah. It was kind of hard to have this on the list. But Clooney and Pitt are pretty funny when they're talking about each other's hands and stuff or whatever, when Pitt's offering advice up for what he's doing. So kind of cool. And they were just fleecing him the whole time.
Another good of those Old West. I mean, the Old West is such a rich environment for poker scenes and movies, isn't it? Because apparently all they did back then was shoot people, have sex with prostitutes, and play poker. You know, I don't know how anybody actually made real money back in the Old West, according to movies, you know. But here's a clip from
Maverick,
the remake with Mel Gibson, that would make Joe Navarro super proud.
Oh, what the hell, I feel like being silly. I'll call. It's just a pair of sixes. If you can beat that, you got me licked, and that's
Not totally unpleasant prospect.
I'm out of the game. You put me out of the game.
Yes, I did.
But I didn't do any of my tails. I didn't play with my ring. I didn't twirl my hair. I didn't even flick my teeth.
You held your breath.
No, I wasn't. Did I hold my breath?
Yes.
Did I hold my breath? Well, did I?
See? Sorry. See, usually when you get excited, you tend to breathe heavily.
How do you...
All right, so here's the moral of the story, I think, Chris. Am I right?
Yep.
If you have sex with all your opponents before playing against them, you'll win, right?
Oh, my God. Well, considering that we're an all-guy game in our home game, that's not going to happen.
Hey, you got to be aggressive. You got to do what the other guy's not going to do, right? No, it might have been hard to pick up from that from the clip, but a great scene for the movie. You know, Maverick and Jodie Foster, have carnal knowledge of each other just before this game, and he uses what he knows from that from to bluff her here, and you're right. You exposed another hole, and we should add this to the IMDb continuity problems, right?
Well, she sits there, and she's like, after the thing is over, she goes around the table, and she's like, did I hold my breath? Did I hold my breath? And every single one of them says, yeah, you held your breath. So they all knew she was bluffing, but none of them could call?
All right, well, here's...
Was that because Gambit was sitting behind him?
But here's the hole in your argument, though. Did all these people have sex with her before?
No, that's true, but they all knew she held her breath and thought that was a bluff. So.
They didn't know what that meant. They didn't have the baseline. They haven't established the Joe Navarro baseline on her yet.
But they all knew holding your breath was a bluff, so they should have called. Anybody could have beat a pair of sixes there, and they didn't, and it was because Maverick was acting last, kind of like Gambit behind me in Friday. So that's got to be the reason they didn't call. So I'm trying to put an end to my own inquisitive mind here. But I have to admit, when I was a kid, I loved this next movie, Revenge of the Nerds, and this was absolutely one of my favorite lines and favorite scenes in the movie, and I wasn't even in the poker back then, so let's listen to this one.
Okay, Takashi, what do you got?
Well, I think I have a frush.
What the fuck is a frush?
A frush?
Oh, well, see, I got 2 sevens, and 2 sevens beats a frush.
Oh, thank you.
All right, so obviously we should say not politically correct. Definitely not safe for work, so hopefully you didn't get fired there by...
Well, you know what? Let me tell you what. If you're at work and you're listening to our show and you don't have headphones on and so everyone else can hear you, your biggest concern is not getting fired for hearing that swear. Okay, so I don't think they're getting fired today.
Oh, man. But, you know, here, Ian, I'm a gentleman at the table, right?
Yeah.
I think we need more players like Takashi at the tables.
Well, I certainly don't want more players like Booger, because I want my cards to be clean, so I don't want Booger at my table.
Oh, man.
I don't know if you're a gentleman, though. I mean, you know, you showed me your Jack 9 bluff, so that's not a gentlemanly thing to do, but... So I wouldn't necessarily say that you were a gentleman.
All right, so the next one here, one of my favorite movies from a long time ago. No audio bad because the hand goes on a little too long, but Honeymoon in Vegas. And this one had the most amazing collection of poker scene elements, I think, out there. You got Nicolas Cage, who's invited to this quote-unquote special game, which is all set up, of course, right?
Yeah.
His opponents include a Japanese Elvis impersonator and Jerry Tarkanian.
Yeah.
What an awesome home game, or a poker game to be in, right?
For those of you who don't know, Jerry Tarkanian is the former basketball coach of UNLV.
Yep, the running Rebels, right?
Yep.
So in the end of this, Nick ends up getting cheated by James Caan, it ends up being like $60,000. Of course, Nick Cage doesn't have $60,000. So James Caan conveniently has a solution to the problem where Nick Cage just has to give up his fiance to James for the weekend. You know, in the end, it's not really all as bad as it sounds. I mean, it was Sarah Jessica Parker. I mean, it wasn't like it was anybody cute or anything like that. But still, I mean, it was tough. the actual poker scene was really cool. But my favorite part of this was when Nicolas Cage had to go to Sarah Jessica Parker and explain what happened here. And he was like, do you understand that in a straight flush? That's almost unbeatable. And she deadpans, almost unbeatable is not unbeatable. I know that now. And I just feel for every husband to be at that point, because we've all had that discussion with our wives to be our wives at some point. You know, we're trying to explain to poker and they cut right through all the BS.
Yeah.
They take all the gamble out of you and remind you of the actual odds of things. I love it.
It's a hilarious scene. He's got like this box of chips next to the table that he keeps pulling out loans and handing him like he's a bank. You know, it was just hilarious. And I think I'll bring a towel like Jerry Tarkanian to the home game from now on. So from now on, when you bluff me like that, I could bite it and scream into it without, you know, pissing anybody off. But yeah, it was an interesting scene. But again, there was never really anything in there that we could put for audio. It was just way too long. But the next one we do have audio for, and of course it's got to be one of my favorite movies of all time because it has Rush in it significantly in this movie.
That's right.
It's I Love You, Man.
Let me ask you guys. Beatles, Stones, on the count of three. One, two, three.
All In.
Beatles.
Fuck you, I don't care.
Nice.
All In.
Here it is.
That too, pal.
I will call in. Too much for that you're in. Anybody else? Just me and you?
Yeah. Ooh.
That's it? All right.
That's it.
Trip Queens.
Nice.
Oh.
Three ladies.
Nice hand.
Finally.
Nice.
Fucking
finally.
Wait,
let's see what
he's got.
Nothing. I have five spades.
He's got the flush.
Here's one. Three, three, four,
flush.
He's a fucking asshole. I'm not going to relax.
I said you're an asshole, Peter.
Take it easy.
What are you standing with seven dudes suited? With a fucking rainbow rag flop.
Take the fucking natives here. I'm buying it. I'm sorry. I don't know.
Just give me some more chips.
I didn't know it was a rainbow.
Oh, man. All right. So this is the reason, Chris, that newbies are scared to play poker, isn't it?
I think so.
You know, because, you know, they get the verbal abuse when they have no idea what they're doing. But, you know, I'm quite fine having Jon Favreau abuse me like that anytime. I mean, the detail in his rage was great. And Jeff Hayasaki.
That's why I waited. That's why I paused. I wanted you to pronounce that name, see how you did.
He wrote, he said, it's a quick scene, but it's the most hilarious scene for average poker players you'll only get if you play poker. Very, very funny. And you're right. I mean, anybody else is going to laugh about the scene, but if you're a poker player, you totally understand where Jon Favreau is just blowing up here. I mean, he's like, oh, three queens, that's great. I just got five spades.
Well, what's funny, though, is it really did make me feel like they actually consulted someone who actually knows how to play poker. When he's talking about trip queens and what are you doing staying in after the flop with just seven deuce, and those things are things that you would hear at a poker table, and those are hands that you wouldn't play. And, of course, they picked the worst starting hand in poker and hold'em. And so, I mean, it really felt like somebody in that cast or somebody writing that movie knew how to play poker, or they consulted with someone who did. So that was kind of cool too, just making it yet another notch above all other movies. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, and this reminds me too, you know, my wife comes home from work probably once every 3 months, and there's some new person that starts there, and either he's interested in poker, or it's a woman and his boyfriend or husband's interested in poker, and everybody knows that I'm married to her, so they're like, oh, you should go see Laura because I know Scott plays poker. And she always said, wait, hold on. You don't want to play with them. And it's not that we were playing for these massively high stakes, right? But this is what I think her fear is that this is going to be Paul Rudd. Just looking for a friendly poker game, comes in and does something like this, and then we all jump on the poor guy. And he goes home, you know... terribly
sick. Yes, you know, I recall a certain day in time when Laura Long tried to dissuade me from entering the fray of the Scott Long home game and told me that I would lose, but I'll have fun. And I took that to heart and made sure I did not lose when I played with you guys the first time.
She's an excellent gatekeeper for you.
Yeah, so I actually ended up joining it, and now we have a magazine and a show. So maybe we should let her let those people make their own minds up and not stop them from joining our home game.
All right, the next one, I'm really bummed that we don't have audio. And actually, it was really hard to find on the web. You actually had to, like, you know, give up your Facebook password to even listen to it, which sucks. But Mr. Mom, way back in the 80s, Michael Keaton, of course, is Mr. Mom. He was at home. And they have this great poker scene. You know, you and I play for Skittles. They're playing for coupons. So he's there in the kitchen table. It looks just like a robot poker game. And they're raising, 25% off coupons for, bird's eye corn. And, of course, even though it's coupons, they don't dispense with the string raises at all, which is a theme through almost all of these scenes, isn't it?
Yeah.
How many of them had, I see you're 100 and raise you 400? Sometimes it's not even logical. But there, they're like, oh, I'll see a 50-cent coupon, and I'll raise you to a $2 coupon. And then when I heard that, I'm like, what's a $2 off coupon worth in 1983?
Today's money?
$47? I mean, yeah. That's a huge raise, isn't
that's
it?
That's a massive amount of money back then, man.
You can buy a lot of cereal for that.
Well, as my wife would tell you, that's real money. I'm sorry, but my wife is not one of those couponaholics, and she's an extreme couponer, and my house now is full of stockpiles of stuff, and she's literally paying just 10%. And so she would say that's money. So if that's true, could the cops bust that game up?
Absolutely.
I mean, they're playing for something of value, right?
There's a .0001 cash value on every one of those coupons.
Can you imagine, though, that story? Police in Pinellas Park, Florida today busted up a home game. There was $8,000 in coupons on the table. I mean, that's just crazy. But it's real money.
Yeah, now here's the thing, though. Technically, it would be a super high-stakes coupon game to violate Florida law, because Florida law, we're allowed to have a pot up to $10. And again, it's the cash value of the coupon, not the printed value. So we would need to take the entire Sunday run of the Tampa Bay Times and all the coupons there.
But, officer, it was a BOGO weekend. We had to play.
It kind of reminds me, hey, if you have just like an extra ounce of marijuana, it goes from misdemeanor to felony. That's exactly the same thing. Oh my gosh, you had to bring the $2 coupon today. Push this into the felony. All right, we're going to close with what I think is undisputable, and I'll be happy to let people dispute with me. But I think it's the undisputable best poker scene ever from a non-gaming movie.
Also, this is not the first time it's making an appearance on the NEA PokerCast. We've actually had this clip back when we were at the Times and played this, and I think it had something to do with Gambit, too. I think Gambit somehow save it to us or send it to us as a something. But, this is actually the greatest scene ever. It comes from Stripes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I'm still in. Cruz, how about you?
Maybe I should fold.
Well, let me see. Let me see first. No, not with a hand like that. Come on. Dare me. Go on. Bluff me. Come on.
How much should I bet?
If it were me, I'd bet everything. But that's me. I'm an aggressive gambler. Mr. Vegas. Come on. Go for it. Go for it. Yes, yes. There we go. I'm in.
What you got?
Well, I got a full house. 3 threes and 2 sixes. That's a full house. What have you got?
Well, you have fours. I got an ace.
You got an ace, an eight, and a seven. Well, you lose, you see. If you would have had 4 fours, you would have won. You're getting good at this, aren't you? You like it? Isn't this fun? You're pretty good for first time, really.
Yeah, well, I know our good friend Amy Mack, she immediately sent in right after we announced this and said, it begins and ends with John Candy and Stripes. Am I right?
Yes.
Yes, you are right. You're always right.
You are right.
He's in the dumb guy poker, tells him, if I were you, I'd bet it all. That's just me, aggressive gambler, Mr. Vegas. And, of course, takes all of his money. All of his money. My hero.
Yeah, the late John Candy. That was a great, great scene. And it's funny, when I listened to it again, I only realize now that the guy actually had a pair of fours. I thought he didn't even have that. I thought he had like ace high or something. From remembering it, I didn't hear him say it properly. I thought he says, "Oh, okay, you got a four and a five," but he had you got fours and a five and a whatever. So he actually had a pair. So I mean, hey,
that's something.
It wasn't like he was totally bluffing or totally telling him to call with a non-hand,
And a lot of these they're really good to go back and look at now, because obviously I saw Stripes well before I started playing poker, right?
Yeah.
And you appreciate it different now when you've been playing poker than you did back then. I mean, back then I was just, hoping my dad left the little key in the cable box so I could see the boobies on Stripes. Now, when you look at the at the senior, it's just classic poker. I mean, like, oh, you think I'm a fool? Let me see your hand. Let me think. And he just grabs his hand, and the guy's like, "Pie." Let's look at him. Oh no, no, no! I would be in with that.
And then after he loses, he's like, "Yeah, I'm starting to get the hang of this now."
Yeah, you're getting really good.
I'm starting to get it. Classic. Well, I want to thank everybody for sending in their clips and their ideas. This has been a long time coming, and I'm glad it finally came to fruition. Some of this stuff just makes me itch to play some more. You know what I mean? I just love watching these clips, and you know, who knows? We may have missed some, and if we missed any, let us know. Maybe we'll talk about them again on another show.
This is Joe Navarro, and you're listening to the best poker cast in all the universe. Ante Up, the absolute best on poker.
It comes from Jerry Spinner. I don't know if that's his real name.
Yeah, it sounds fake.
It does sound fake, doesn't it?
Yeah, like Jerry Rig and Spinner. I mean, it just sounds like...
Sounds like a movie name, right? Maybe it's a name of guy that's in a poker scene somewhere. Uncredited, Jerry Spinner. All right, so he says, I've been listening to the show since the beginning. Love it. Thank you very much. We love you, too.
When they say the beginning, you think they mean like from episode one at the times, or they?
You know, sometimes people want to be sure that we don't question that, and they actually mention something from the first show.
Yeah, yeah.
To prove it, yeah. Almost like they got a scalp. You know, I'm not just talking about it. I actually listened to that 5-minute atrocity and came back the next week. He says he called in after his first ever big cash of $32,000, the Caesars Classic.
Wow. Good
brag. And he said, this was before you guys were hobnobbing with millionaires every week for the magazine.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Well, of course it was, because we're still not hobnobbing with millionaires. We'd love to. He says, you guys commented on how one of our listeners had some Player of the Year points and how you've grown since then. He says, his big problem is every hand of the week, the person says, quote, I think about raising, then I just call. And this drives me nuts. So with that said, here's my possible hand of the week. I'm in a 50-cent, $1, no-limit hold'em game on True Poker, and I'm in the big blind with 90. I believe that's $90, not 90 cents. And I have ace-jack of hearts. All right, the cutoff is a tight regular who also knows I play tight and has 110 in front of him and raises to $3. The loose fish in the small blind calls... And it's on us now with ace jack of hearts.
Okay. I'm out of position. It's not a great hand. If I'm going to play it, I don't think I'm raising with it. I'm just calling and seeing the flop. I can't. I mean, I realize from what he said, I have to go by what he says. And he says the cutoff is tight. So, and he's a regular. So, I mean, if he raised to $3, he's probably got. He could have a hand. Doesn't necessarily mean anything. I tend to think that cutoffs don't usually raise with nothing in cash games. They're not stealing the button for position. I mean, sometimes they are, but it's not usually nothing. It usually happens in tournaments. Mm-hmm. For the most part, I'm not saying that it doesn't happen in a cash game, because it does, especially if you're the player that he thinks he can outplay. So, but...
And add to that the fact this is a tight regular, isn't
it? Yeah, that's what I was saying. He's tight. Yeah. So the fact that he's tight and he raised means that he could have a pretty good hand here. So a re-raise, I mean, you don't know if he's that tight and you re-raise and he knows you know he's that tight, he might fold. But ace-jack is still a marginal hand. If it wasn't suited, I might even consider folding it, to be honest with you. But it's suited and, you know, we got a loose player in the middle here, so I'll probably just call the $2 and see the flop getting 3-1 on my money or whatever.
Yeah, I think this is kind of a theme that's showing up in our hands of the week. I think the one that's probably going to be on the show here in a couple weeks that had a good back and forth with a folk person on, and that email was the subject line was Ace Freaking Queen. And it's true. I mean, you know, this is one of the leaks that I'm plugging my game. You know, as you start playing, you start thinking that these big aces are all good hands, and they are in the right situation.
Yeah.
But when somebody is raised from under the gun, all of a sudden, ace queen, ace jack, ace ten, those hands don't look anywhere near as good as they are. Now, this isn't an under the gun, but it's a tight regular player from the cutoff, so I'm still not excited about my ace jack of hearts. And, you know, if I'm going to play this, I'm going to call it, and I'm going to be pretty strict that I'm looking for two pair or better flush draw, straight draw, something like that.
Yeah.
I'm not excited about an ace or even a jack at this point if I make this call.
I agree. I mean, if a jack came and it was jack uncoordinated and jack was top pair, I might do a check raise or
absolutely
whatever. But really, yeah, I'm with you. I'm calling here and seeing what happens.
All right. Well, our hero says he thinks about raising, but then just calls. He says he has no idea why. Maybe just so I can get on hand of the week. It works.
No, I don't think that's a wrong play, though. I mean, he's thinking about raising, but I think we've thought it through, and a raise probably isn't, because you're just going to lose more money if the guy has ace king and re-raises you again or has a really good hand. So you're hoping to flop big and take his money rather than put money in there for no, you know, yeah, for no reason.
Going on. Right. All right. The flop is a 10 of hearts, 9 of hearts, deuce of clubs, and the small blind checks to us.
Again, I think a check raise is probably appropriate here. We have two overs and backdoor straight draws and nut flush draw. So betting out here, it would make a lesser hand just go away. Not that necessarily is a bad thing, but we have a pretty strong hand, and a check raise is pretty ideal here because we're going to say, okay, we're giving up to the preflop raiser, let him continuation bet, and then you get some money out of it. Whereas if you bet now, you may lose him. So, you know, he could have queens or jacks and then or whatever, or kings or something like that, and you wouldn't lose him, but you just don't know. And generally, they don't have a pair. So I would check raise here, I think, if I had an opportunity. So let's check.
Yeah, I can argue that. I can also argue putting out a bet here to kind of control the pot a little bit, because I think if you bet here, it kind of a little misdirection. I don't think anybody would put you on a flush draw by betting out here. So if you do hit the hearts, then maybe you can get a little bit more money out of somebody that might represent the hearts when you have them. You know, hey, if we take it down here with just ace high, I'm fine with that as well, too. So, I mean, I could defend a small bet here.
I would disagree.
I wouldn't
a little
want to
bit.
Get raised, though. Is it?
Yeah, I would disagree because of a couple of reasons. One, that's the main thing. You can get raised right out of this hand. Or the fact that you've bet out now, and then what happens when he calls? And then the turn you miss, now you check. And if you check, right,
well,
he takes it away from you, right?
Let me ask you this. It's, how much different is it playing it your way, which I'm not saying you're wrong. I might play your way too. But, I mean, if we're check raising, we'll probably end up putting the same amount of money in that if we bet here and we get raised, correct? So the money's probably about the same.
I think it's the...
And then we're still in the same situation. If we miss on the... When you check raise here and you miss on the turn, are you automatically going to bet even though you missed?
I think I probably would. It's all
really, it doesn't change anything, really.
I guess so, but it's the story that you're telling. And also, you're guaranteeing yourself more. You're not guaranteeing, but you're thinking you're going to get more money in the pot by check raising than you would by just check calling. You know what I mean? Or not even that. He could check behind and not get any money at all. Whereas if you check and then he thinks you're weak and bets, now you raise, you've put a fear in him. If he calls you on the turn, there might be a different feel, a different story being told on that turn if you check raise him. Now you've check raised and he called, and now you're checking to control the size of the pot rather than checking because you're afraid. You know, I mean, I just feel like there's a different feel with a check raise story being told if he happens to call you. Like you said, I don't mind taking it down here, but a check raise gets me more money by taking it down rather than a bet out and a fold by him. So
I don't disagree, but I think it sets you up for some tougher decisions, which are not necessarily bad decisions. But, you know, I think if you bet out here and you get raised, then you can reasonably check the turn if it's not a heart, because they know you're not going to bet again. Whereas if you check raise, you're almost committing yourself to having to bet that turn. And if you don't, then it makes you look kind of a little weird.
I think if you check call, if you bet out first on this flop and get called and miss the turn and you don't bet, you're going to lose the hand.
That's true too.
But if you check raise somebody,
you're worried about getting raised though. If we bet out here, we get raised, we're still putting in essentially the same amount of money as if we checked and check raised, and then we get the option of not having to feel like we need to bet the turn.
Well, I just feel like you're going to lose the hand.
Hopefully the hearts will come and we don't have to worry about it.
You have to remember though, you've taken control of the hand on a check raise. You've given up control on a check call. So I just feel like it's the impression that the hand is giving, the impression you're giving the guy, and I'd be more inclined to bet the turn if I miss now, because I've given the impression that, hey, we always say this on the show, what does a check raise tell you? It tells you that that person was willing to give a free card because his hand is so strong. That's a lot of the impression you get. So by, true. You know what I mean? So I just think if I bet the turn now by missing, I'm telling this guy, now I'm protecting against a flush, and he's going to have a monster to call my turn bet. And then if he calls again, I still got the hearts back up on a river. So that's why I like the check raise there. But we can move on.
All right. Well, our hero says, I check knowing the original raiser will see bet. And he does the six. And a small blind folds. Pot is now 15. And I know what you're going to do, right?
Yeah, I would raise.
All right. And that's exactly what he does. I check raise to 18. The raiser takes a little time, then calls.
Okay.
All right, the turn is the ace of spades. So our board now is 10 of hearts, 9 of hearts, deuce of clubs, ace of spades. And we've improved to top pair. But this is what I was talking about before. We're not very excited about the top pair necessarily.
Yeah, although to me, if the guy had like ace king, he wouldn't have called the check raise. So, to me, that ace has to hurt him. It can't help him. He's not calling with ace-queen a check raise. Mm-hmm. He's not calling with ace... Even ace-10, maybe ace-10 is the hand that I'm losing to here now. But to me, the ace is a good card, because if he called there, I don't think he has an ace, unless he has a set. And if he had a set, he probably wouldn't have called. He probably would have raised again, because we were check-raising him. So, he wants to protect against a straight and flush draws. So... To me, the mere call, in my mind, a call there is telling me that he doesn't have ace-king, ace-queen, or even ace-jack. And now that the ace has come, it's a good card for us.
All right. I like that.
That's how I feel. I mean, we could be getting killed here. I don't know. But it just feels that way.
All right. Well, the pot's 45. What are we going to do?
I'm going to bet now because I check raise and I want to take control
absolutely.
Of the hand.
And we got lucky. We actually had a card that I think we got lucky.
I would probably bet like $30 here.
All right, our hero leads out for 20, which is a little less than half the pot.
Mm.
Leaves him with 49 behind, and the original raiser goes all in.
Yeah, I can't fold. I mean, I've got so much money committed after what he did. I have aces with a decent kicker and the nut flush redraw. And even a jack could be a win for us too. So that's all. To me, that's a pretty decent hand, and there's so much. I only have 40 something bucks left. This pot's pretty big now. I can't let it go now. I don't think I can fold here.
Yeah, we're calling 49 to win 114, is what he says.
Yeah, so that's plenty of money for me. And with outs, you know, my hand doesn't even have to be good. I have outs. So even if I'm wrong, you know, Jack could win it for us. Another ace could win it for us. We don't know what this guy has. I have no idea. And then the hearts will definitely win for us. So unless it's a straight flush somehow.
Right. But, that only happens in the movies.
Yeah, exactly. All because of this thing. yeah, I can't fold now.
All right, well, that's what our hero does. He calls. Villain flips over. Ace of diamonds, deuce of diamonds.
Oh, my God.
This has given me so many outs, I'm not going to count them. But a seven on the river, and I lose what sucks, but also gives me a good shot at hand of the week, as most hands from players are hands that players lose.
I mean, really, he check raised him, and the guy stuck around with deuces and an ace kicker. That's pretty bad. And I thought this guy was tight. How tight is this guy? He's playing ace deuce suited.
Well, maybe he had a bad read on him, or our opponent has a different read on us than we think he might. That's what's always interesting in these relationships. I mean, you think you know somebody, but you know at some point there's shifts in gears, or maybe you're wrong, and then you make. You know, a lot of decisions based on that information, which might end up being faulty. So I'm not saying that's what happened here, but it very likely could be. You know,
I still even if I know the guy is ace deuce, I still might call because I have so many. I have more outs now than I did. Any nine, any ten. You know, and then any jack, and then any heart. You know, I just feel like that's to me. I probably still call. I mean, that's crazy. This guy stuck around with a check raise. And raised with it, with ace deuce, and then call the check raise. That's crazy with just deuces. But you know the ace ends up being the worst card for us because if it's not an ace, the guy goes away with any bet. So crazy. You just never know what to expect out there.
All right, Jerry, we appreciate you sending us the hand of the week. And he also said he's going to see us at the meetup in Vegas.
So awesome.
We'll ask for a photo ID to see whether he really is named Jerry Spitter at that point. Jerry, we're going to send you a grinder bracelet from Pro Poker Gear, which sells much more than terrific bracelets for home games or leagues, including hats, t-shirts, and gifts in the AnyUp store at AnyUpStore.com. And everybody else, send your hands of the week to podcast@AnyUpMagazine.com, and you too might be a winner.
Officially,
even
Birds,
if you're a loser.
Bird's Eye Vegetables is not a sponsor of the show. Just want to make sure everybody knows that. And once again, thanks everybody for sending in your ideas and scenes from non poker movie clips. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
AnyUp is a production of AnyUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnyUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnyUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.